Okay, so the story I want to talk about is a very short story, as opposed to last year we did Ha'agunah, which was a much longer story. This story is very short. It's El HaRofe, to the doctor. I guess we might as well just read through the story to get our bearings in it. It's very short. It's one of a series of stories by Agnon, which are have a bit of a surreal feel to them. You know, it's not, things are a bit strange. They don't really come to a conclusion. For the most part, the translation is accurate. There is one line in the translation that I think is wrong, and I'll just note it as we go through it. We'll go back and forth. Well, when I need the Hebrew, I'll go back to it, but just to get into the story, it's very short, so we might as well read it. So it goes like this. Father lay ill, and a moist cloth was bound around his head. His face was weary from illness, and a heavy worry dulled his blue eyes, like a man who knows his death is near, but doesn't know what will happen to his young sons and daughters. Opposite him, in another room, lay my little sister. Each was ill with a different illness, for which the doctor had not yet given a name. Right, so it's a very morbid beginning. We have this, the protagonist of the story, his two sick relatives. He has his father, and he has his little sister. And both of them, the cure is elusive, because they don't even know the disease that his relatives have. My wife stood in the kitchen and shelled peas from their pods. After she placed them in the pot, she put on her wrap and went with me to the doctor. As I was leaving the house, I stumbled upon some peas. For when my wife was busy preparing them for eating, they had rolled out of her hands and scattered on the stairs. I wanted to sweep them away before the mice would smell them and come, but I was rushed. It was already past 8:30, and at 9 o'clock the doctor used to visit his friends and drink with them all night. While at home, there lay two sick persons who needed special attention, particularly my little sister, who used to caper and sing, exciting our anxiety lest she fall from her bed or disturb father from his sleep. All right, so he's going out, and in the middle of this very dramatic moment, he's running to the doctor. His wife is cooking, and there are some peas which spilled on the floor, and he wants to make sure that the mice don't eat them. He doesn't really have time to clean it up, because he has to run out to get the doctor. Now, this doctor, the irony of the whole story hangs on this, is that the one doctor who can help his father and sister, right, this expert doctor, that's the feeling you get, is a drunkard, right? At 9 o'clock at night, right? No matter what happens, he leaves his house, he's gone. He's at the bar. You can't access him, right? So the picture is very, very odd. You know, you would think, right, someone devotes their life to medicine, right, someone's dying, you'd be able to go to the bar, take him out, but the assumption of the story that's never questioned is that you can't do that, right? Once the doctor goes to the bar, that's it, right? You have no chance at getting him, so you have to catch him before 9 o'clock. Then he, in the middle of this whole moment, he focuses on the peas, right? Those peas began to bother me. Now, the translation here says, because they turned into lentils. Now, that, I think, is a bad translation. Because if you look at the Hebrew, it said, shenitchalfu li ba'adashim, right? Nitchalfu li, right? The English makes it sound like they magically transformed into lentils, right? Nitchalfu li is like I got them confused with, right, with lentils, right? I thought they were lentils. They weren't. They were peas, but I thought they were lentils. Now, why does that bother him? So they bothered him, as he tells you, because lentils are a food of trouble and mourning. Traditionally, in rabbinic literature, we have circle food, right, round foods, in periods of mourning, lentils being one of them, eggs being another, because they're round, they represent the circle of life, or they have no opening, they have no, which Chazal say they have no pet, they have no mouth, because in mourning, there's nothing to say, they're perfectly round, but they're a traditional food of mourning, and since the scene is so morbid already, seeing the lentils, or thinking he sees lentils, just sets him off, right? It's like, you know, it would be like he's going to the doctor, and he accidentally, right, tears his shirt, right, where you would tear kriya, right? That's basically the imagery of what's going on. He sees morning food, and he panics. So it's easy to understand the sorrow of a man who has two sick persons at home, and things put this kind of thought into his heart. Now, it's not proper to tell that I was a bit resentful towards my wife, and I thought to myself, what good are women? She had toiled to prepare a meal for us, and at the end, all the peas had scattered. When I saw she was running and knew why she was running, my resentment disappeared and love entered my heart. Right? And then at this moment, right, in the middle of it all, his father is dying, his sister is dying, For a moment, he just gets angry at his wife for spilling the peas, which he thinks are lentils. But then it all changes, right? Because his wife is running after him to escort him to the doctor, and the anger, the hatred dissipates, and he loves his wife again. Now, on his way, gets stranger, on his way right next to the Black Bridge, Mr. Underman met me and greeted me. I returned his greeting and wanted to leave him. He held my hand and told me that he'd just arrived from the city of Bordeaux in England. Right, not Bordeaux, France, but Bordeaux, England. And today or tomorrow, he and his father would come to see our new house. Aye, 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 said Mr. Underman. They tell me all sorts of wonders about your house. I contorted my face to give it a pleasing expression and reflected. Why does he say he will come with his father? Does Mr. Underman have a father? Right, and now the story just gets weirder, right? He meets this weird Mr. Underman, and the first thing he thinks is, does he have a father? Now, I don't know what that means, right? Does he questioning whether he ever had a father, which he grew up with the father, whether his father is alive, right? Especially in the Hebrew, right? I didn't know if he had a father, right? It sounds like if he ever had a father, which is obviously not what it means, but it gives more of this surreal feel to Mr. Underman. Maybe he's parentless, right? He's just this mythic figure. It's not quite clear what's going on, but it's... And I reflected further, couldn't this excessive attempt to give my face a pleasing appearance leave an impression after it? I remember the peas which had turned into lentils, and I began to worry about retribution. Right in the middle of this, he again panics about the lentils and the peas, right? So that Mr. Underman might not realize what was in my heart, I put my hand into my pocket and took out my watch. I saw that 9 o'clock was near, and at 9, the doctor used to go to his club and get drunk. While there at home lay two sick persons whose illness had no name. When Mr. Underman saw that I was in haste, he understood in his usual way that I was hurrying to the post office. He said, the postal arrangements have changed and you don't have to hurry. Right? Right? So now Mr. Underman tells him, oh, you must be going to the post office. And he assures him that the hours have changed at the post office, which I don't understand either, because the chances the post office was ever open at 9 o'clock at night, right, are unlikely, right? Not before the time change, not before not after the time change. I left Mr. Underman in his error, and I didn't tell him about the sick persons, lest he bother me with advice and detain me. Then came a stately old man in whose house of study used to pray on the high holy days, right? He's trying to get to this doctor, right, before he goes to the bar. And instead, he meets the chazan from Yom Kippur, right? He meets the person who davens, who prays on Yom Kippur, on Rosh Hashanah, on the high holy days at his synagogue. I've heard many cantors, but I've not heard a Baal Tefillah like him, whose prayer is beautiful and clear even during his crying. I'd wanted to speak to him many times, but I never could. Now he set upon me his eyes, which were bleary from crying, and looked at me affectionately, as if he were saying, here I am, let us talk if you wish. Mr. Underman grasped my hand and didn't let me go. Actually, I could have removed my hand from his and gone off. But on this very same day, a dog had bitten me and torn my clothes, and had I turned my face from Mr. Underman and gone, he would have seen the tear. Right? So in the middle of this, right, he's there with this Mr. Underman and the nameless cantor, and he wants to leave, but he's ashamed, because if he turns around, they'll see that he has a tear in his clothes from a dog that bit him. And I remember the time when the old man stood before the reader's desk during the prayer, and because of our sins, and beat his head on the floor until the walls of the house of study quaked. My heart quaked, and I was drawn towards him, but Mr. Underman grasped my hand, and I stood and twisted my face and tried to give it a pleasing expression. My wife crossed the bridge and reached the doctor's house, which was next to the post office, and stood before the entrance of the house, her shoulders twitching from sorrow and waiting. I removed my hand from Mr. Onderman's hand and went towards my wife. The Black Bridge quaked under my feet, and the waves of the river swelled and rose, rose and swelled. Now that's the story, right? There's this very weird, mythic quality to it, not clear what's going on, right? There's no conclusion, right? The whole story is him trying to get to the doctor and meeting this Mr. Underman who detains him. We don't know why he detains him. The confusion about the post office, running into the chazan from Yom Kippur, remembering the prayers from Yom Kippur, and then, at last minute, in fact, reaching near the post office, which not clear why that's in the story to begin with. It's a very weird story, right? It's of that genre, right? Agnon has a series of stories that are of this genre. Trying to interpret everything and unpack everything will be difficult, but I want to focus, as I did last year, because this is my favorite part of Agnon, on the biblical story that I think this is based on that begins to give us an insight in what's going on here. And the story that I think this is a, shall we say, a commentary on, in many ways, is the story of Yaakov, the story of Jacob. And first let me outline why I think that's true, and then I want to get into what that would mean for the story. So let's go through the life of Jacob, right? The life of Yaakov. So Yaakov is born a twin. He's born a twin, Yaakov and Esav, Jacob and Esau. They're born twins. When they're born, so one of them is hairy and red, one of them is fair-skinned and smooth, right? Jacob is smooth and fair-skinned, and Esav is red and hairy. The kids grow up, and then at some point when they grow up, so Esav is the firstborn, and Jacob wants to be the firstborn. So the Torah tells us that Esav comes home one day, and he's famished, and he turns to Jacob, and he says, he sees that Jacob is cooking. What's he cooking? He's cooking lentils. Nizid Adashim, right? He's cooking lentils. Now, why is he cooking lentils? So the Torah doesn't tell you why he's cooking lentils, but in the Midrash, which is quoted by Rashi, he's quoting lentils because lentils is a food of mourning. And Avram, his grandfather, had died that day. And his father, Yitzchak, his father Isaac, was therefore in mourning. And at this moment, Esav comes in and says, look, I need that food. I need that red stuff. And Jacob says, fine, I have a deal for you. You sell me the firstborn rights, I'll give you the lentils. Says, deal. He gives it, he devours it, he gulps it down. And the Torah describes that he eats it in haste and he leaves. And he denigrates the value of the firstborn, right? Selling it for some soup. That's story one. Then they get a little bit older, and Yitzchak is ill. Their father is ill. He's blind, in bed, and he's dying. And what does he do? So he tells Esav, his older son, who was the hunter, go and get me food so that I can bless you. So Esav goes, and Rivka, Yitzchak's wife, overhears and says, I can't deal with this, right? The one who should be blessed is Yaakov. She tells Yaakov, come, you've got to go in, you've got to get the bracha. Instead, he says, I can't. My father's going to realize I'm tricking him, so she says, don't worry, I'll help you. She puts on Esav's clothes on him so that he feels like Esav prepares food as well, brings the food in. So Yaakov brings the food into his father, pretends to be his brother. Yitzchak realizes something is off, feels his skin, and he says the famous words, Akol kol Yaakov, Yadayim de Esav, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, but the hands are the hands of Esav. But in the meantime, he blesses him. As he's leaving, Esav is coming in, right? You know, you get like the image of him like hiding behind the door and running out or whatever exactly is going on. Esav comes in and he says, I brought the food. Yitzchak panics and said, who are you? He said, I'm Esav. He said, no, I just gave the bracha to Esav. He realized what happened. And there's a deception. Esav is furious. He says he's going to kill Yaakov, not to Yitzchak, but he says in his heart he's going to kill Yaakov as soon as his father dies, but he'll wait until his father dies. To prevent this, Rivka tells her son Yaakov, flee, and flee to my brother's house, to your uncle, which he does. He flees to the house of his uncle, spends 20 years there, 7 years working for Rachel, right, for Rachel, married, right, and then after the 7 years, he ends up being switched and tricked and marries Leah, and then he works another 7 years, right, marries Rachel a week later, then works another 7 years and then another 6 years, and eventually leaves Laban's house and eventually comes home, only to face an army of 400 people with his brother Esav, and they eventually make up, and that's the end of that part of the saga. Then he has, you know, during this whole period, he's having children, mostly from Leah, who's his hated wife, as the Torah describes him, but his less loved wife, the wife that he was never supposed to have. His beloved wife has trouble having children. Eventually, she's blessed with a child. Yosef, when she has her second child, poor Yaakov, loses his wife again. He loses another beloved family member, loses his beloved wife, Rachel, doesn't even manage to be buried with her, buries her in on the way, right? Efrat derech Beit Lechem. And this is Yaakov's life, right? Yaakov's life is a very sad life, difficult life. Of all the patriarchs, all the Avot is described with a very, very difficult life. But if we think broadly about Yaakov's life, there's a few characters that, and few scenes that jump out that in this story play central roles. Right? So, number one, right? Perhaps the longest story described with Yaakov, the longest single incident, is the story of his dying elderly father at home. Right? That's that dramatic moment. His father is dying. He wants to bless his son. Now, who is the younger sister? Right? Yaakov never loses a younger sister. But the truth is, he does. He does use a younger sister. Because the Hebrew, if you look at the Hebrew of the story, right? His younger sister, the Hebrew of younger sister is, right? Is achoto, is achot tana. Right, achoto aktana. Let me just get it in the story. It's, it should be right there. Wait, where's the story? Let me start here. Oh, yeah. Here. I know it got stapled backwards, but okay. Right, achoti aktana. Now, so you would say, achoti aktana, he doesn't have a younger sister, but he does, because Lavan, right, Lavan's two daughters are Leah and Rachel. And Yaakov tells Lavan, I want to marry Rachel, bitcha aktana, your younger daughter. But then after 7 years of working for Rachel, and Lavan tricks them, and he switches them. What does Lavan say? Lavan justifies himself. And we'll look at these sources in a minute. And he says, why did I do it? You know, I'll just jump to it now. I put it, you know, like I'm not reading all the sources. I put it here, and as we go, we'll draw on them as we need them. But,
it's not our way.
Right, but what's not our way? So he says, right, in number 9. Right, he says, Vayhi vaboke vinehi le'ah vayomer lavan mazo dasitali. He wakes up in the morning, he finds out it's the wrong wife. So he says to him, what do you do to me? Halo v'rachel avati imach v'lam le'rimitani. I work for Rachel. Vayomer lavan lo ye'asachen bimkomenu la'teda tzira lefnei abichira. Right, we don't give the younger one before the older one. Right, what's the definition? The definition of Rachel in the story. Right, the whole drama is about the fact that she is achota aktana, the younger sister. And she's the younger sister. Now, parenthetically, besides for in this context, right here it's Seira, though earlier it is the achot aktana. There's only one other time in Tanakh that achot aktana, right, is mentioned.
Shir Hashirim.
Right, and I wonder whether that's related. Right, that Shir HaShirim is playing on the Rachel imagery, because Rachel is the paradigmatic beloved wife, right? In contrast to other women who are not Leah, right? And in Shir HaShirim, you also have the Achot Haktana, right? The younger, but there it's not younger sister. It's the brothers are talking and saying our younger sister is in love with the dode. But Rachel is the beloved wife and the younger sister, and she in fact does die, right? So the two sick characters here are the elderly father and the younger sister, which are the two characters that Yaakov loses tragically in his life. He loses Yitzchak, right? The most dramatic story we know of him is the story which surrounds the death of his father and the death of his beloved wife, who's defined, right? The whole confusion, the only reason he has two wives to begin with is because she's the achot haktana, which gives Lavan the pretext to switch the wives, which creates the situation in which he ends up marrying another wife who he doesn't like. But now, if we continue, it gets even, right? There's more evidence of this, right? So, what other evidence would we have for this? So it's not just that he married both wives. Right. So if you look at 10, the Torah says explicitly, "Vayara Hashem ki snua Leah vayiftach et rachma v'Rachel akara," that God saw that Leah was unloved, so He opened her womb, and Rachel was barren. Right? Leah is hated. Leia is hated. Now, who in our story is hated? Right, who in LROFA is hated? Though momentarily.
The wife.
The wife. Why is she hated?
Because
she dropped the peas. Where's that image from? So that image is a Mishnah. If you look at number 11, the last Mishnah in Gittin, which describes the different the different reasons that one could have for divorcing a wife. So the Mishnah tells you in 11, if you look at 11, I'm going to skip around a little bit as we use it, but if you look at number 11, there are three positions in the Mishnah. Beit Shammai says that a man can't divorce his wife unless he finds her to be unchaste, right? She commits adultery. Beit Hillel says, right, in Hebrew, afilu hikticha tavshilo, even if she burns the food, right? And then Rabbi Akiva says, even if he finds someone he likes better. But what is the right? We paskin parenthetically, right? We rule halachically like Beit Hillel, right? That even for any pretext, if their relationship isn't working out. Now, I don't want to get into this too much. My teacher, Michael Rosenzweig, used to say that, right, you want to understand the Mishnah properly. Right, the Mishnah sounds very capricious, right? Someone divorces his wife because she burns the food. He said, no. What the Mishnah is telling you is if their relationship is so fragile that it enters his mind to divorce his wife because she burned the food, right, that's evidence of a relationship that is already so poisoned that it's legitimate to divorce. But however you want to interpret the Mishnah, the paradigmatic case of a wife who's hated and is getting divorced in halachic literature is somebody who burns the food, who messes up with the cooking. So,
but
the
if she
wife
burns the food and she eats it and she cooks the fresh food for her husband,
then he'll never know. Then he'll never know. But in the story, remember, there's that moment where the wife, right, meaning, right, the one who's actually his wife, which in the Yaakov story, his first wife, right, maybe not the one that was supposed to be his first wife, but realistically it was his wife, she is hated, right? She's hated, that key phrase, he hated her for a moment. But that's the way the Torah describes Leah, ki shnu'a Leah. So you read the story, and the references quickly build up, and you wonder, right? Not to mention that the biggest tip-off, right? These are small tip-offs. The number one tip-off that this story is connected to the Yaakov, Esav, Yitzchak, Rivka, Rachel, Leah narratives is the opening, right? Is that as we started, what was being cooked? Again, the whole story is about the lentils, right? The mixed up lentils, which again, if you look here at one, just to see it inside, right? We already said the story outside, but in the middle of that story, I gave you the story of the sale of the firstborn, right? The last pasuk, the last verse in Lamed Daled in 34 is VeYaakov Natan LeEsav Lechem UNezid Ad Hashem VaYochav VaYesh VaYakam VaYilach VaYivez Esav Et HaBechorah. That Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew. He ate and he drank and he rose and went away. And Rashi, did I not put it? Oh, well, I mentioned outside. But Rashi there says, again, that the reason he's cooking the lentil stew is because his father, Yitzhak, his father Isaac, was in mourning for Avram. So here again, the story starts off with his wife cooking lentils as his father is ill in bed, right? And he's cooking the food of mourning, and it's not like Agnon hides this, right? Agnon tells you, I panicked because I thought of the lentils, and lentils are the traditional food of mourning, which made me feel like my father was about to die. Right? But he starts the story off with someone cooking lentils, talking about mourning with a sick, dying father, right? You can't get a more, in rabbinic literature, a more direct imagery of the beginning of Yaakov's life. So you look at these hints, and you just get the feeling that it's gotta be, right? It's gotta be that Agnon is in some way connecting this story, writing this story, drawing on images, and I would argue even commenting on the story of Yaakov and Esav, of Jacob and his brother. But that only, right, that requires us to ask a much more fundamental question, which is, okay, so I can point out that there are images, there are allusions to the stories of Yaakov. But what is he doing with those images? I mean, it's very nice to say he loves pulling on images, but Ogden doesn't usually just pull on images for fun, right? There's a reason he does that. And here's what I think is the key to the story. When I first read El Harofe, what strikes me as the central drama in the story, right? The central drama in the story, that's the most painful part of the story. Right? There are a lot of things going on in the story. But the central drama in the story is what? Right? If I had to boil it down, what's the drama that takes you from the beginning of the story till the end?
The doctor closes at 9.
The doctor closes at 9. Now, why is that painful? So we tend to think, right, you read it the first time, you're like, well, it's a drama, right? He has half an hour to get to the doctor. Otherwise, he might lose his father and his sister. But there's a much bigger drama going on here. And think about it. A doctor. When you think of a doctor, what do you think of? What's the image you conjure up in your head?
Giving.
He's giving, right? He signs the Hippocratic Oath, right, to take care of their patients. Right, it's someone who is altruistic, went into a job to help people. This doctor is clearly the expert, right? It's an unknown disease. And the protagonist of the story is convinced. There's only one person who can help his father and his sister. Now, if you were a doctor, you conjure up, pick your favorite doctor in your head, and you told them you're the only person in the world who could save two people's lives. But to do that, you have to give up on your night out at the bar, right? How many of you, when you conjure up that image of the doctor in your head, would be sure, 100%, that if you called the doctor on a cell phone when they're out at the bar, they would drop whatever they're doing, get in their car, rush to the hospital, and help the patients, right? Now, Agnon comes back to the image of the doctor many times throughout his stories, right? Both in his fiction, he also has a story that was only published posthumously, where he talks about a story of a professor who has a model doctor, who's modeled after a doctor who was famous in Israel for having given himself malaria in order to test cures for malaria, right? I mean, he didn't want to try it on anybody else, so he would make himself sick with malaria. When you look through Agnon's other writings, he talks about doctors exactly like this, right? As these amazingly altruistic people who are willing to endanger their own lives to take care of other people. But the drama in this story is that he has half an hour to get to this doctor who, despite the fact that he's the best doctor, the only one who can cure this unknown disease, instead of being altruistic, instead of being in it for the patients, being willing to give up his night, he knows that by 9 o'clock the guy is gone and drunk, right? And you think about it, that's a really weird place to be in. But that's a really weird doctor in the story. That doesn't fit the model of a doctor you think about, or to be fair, the image of the doctor in Ogden's other writings. So when I saw that, that made me wonder, right? Why is this story about the drama of trying to reach a doctor who is such an expert doctor, but also so callous and so uncaring that, you know, you miss him, you miss his night out at the bar, you might as well let your father and sister die, right? That's the story, or that's the drama. There's other parts to the drama, right? There's other people who get in the way. Right, Mr. Underman and the Chazan, we'll come back to them. But the central drama is that the poor man here is dependent on this horrible human being of a doctor. Let's go back to the biblical story for a moment. When we read that story of the life of Jacob, the life of Yaakov, There's one element in the story that I think we overlook, but to our detriment in understanding the biblical drama. And with what I just said, the questions I'd read about the story, I want to go to the story of the stealing of the blessings, right? And then I want to come back to our story. So let's think about this story a little bit, okay? Number two. I can read it in English, right? When Isaac was old, his eyes were too dim to see. He called his older son Esau, and he said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." And he said, "I'm old now, and I do not know how soon I may die. Take your gear, your quiver, and bow, and go out into the open and hunt me some game. Then prepare a dish for me, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may give you my innermost blessings before I die." Rebekah had been listening to Isaac as Isaac spoke to his son Esau, when Esau had gone out to open to hunt game and to bring home. Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I overheard your father speaking to your brother Esau, saying, 'Bring me some game, prepare me a dish for me to eat, that I might bless you with the Lord's approval before I die. Now, my son, listen carefully as I instruct you. Go to the flock, fetch me two choice kids, and I will make of them a dish for your father such as he likes. Then take it to your father to eat, in order that he may bless you before he dies." Jacob answered his mother Rebekah, "But my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am is a smooth-skinned man. And if my father touches me, I'll appear to him as a trickster, and bring upon myself a curse, not a blessing." Okay? So what happens, right? Isaac tells his son, Yitzchak tells his son Esau, he says, "Look, go get me food." Rebekah says, "This can't be. This can't be." And traditional thought says, why can't this be? Because Yitzchak is blind, both physically and metaphorically. He doesn't see his son's failings. Why? Kitzayit b'fiv. Because he loves him, because his son is a hunter. And his son brings him food. And therefore he loves him. But Rivka sees through her sons, and she knows that Esav is not a good person. Yaakov is the one who should inherit the family line. But it's... what's strange about the story is that part of the drama here, right? Much of the drama is this panic that Jacob has, right? That Yaakov has. My father's going to realize he's going to curse me, right? He's going to realize I'm tricking him. But there's a deeper drama, which we don't think about, which is, what's it like? What's it like to be Yaakov? To be the actual righteous, worthy heir, and know that your father loves your brother, the evil, wicked brother. Why? Well, why does he love him? Not for no reason. Why does he love him? Because he is the one who can take care of him. Right? For all his faults, he has one quality. He takes care of his father. And, right, later on in the story, even in his anger, right, even when he is crying, right, because the blessing was stolen from him. Look at 41. You skip down to 41. He says, "Now Esau harbored a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing which his father had given him. And Esau said to himself, 'Let but the mourning period of my father come, and I'll kill my brother Jacob.'" Even he's wicked, he's evil, right? But there's one thing that'll stop him from killing his brother, and that is his father's alive, right? He has a million flaws, but he has one quality. He loves and takes care and honors his father. And in rabbinic literature, it's more than that. I gave you in three. Dvarim Rabbah, the Midrash says, Amar Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, lo kibed briyat avotav kamo ani et avotai. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, no one has honored his parents as much as I honored my parents. Umatzati shikibed esav laviv yoter mimeni. Except for one person. And I'm the best at honoring my parents the whole wide world. But in history, there was one person better than I was. And that was Esav. What's it like to be Yaakov? What's it like to be Jacob? And to say, my brother is terrible. How terrible is he? So look at four. This is rabbinic literature. In rabbinic literature, Esav is, right, in the verses, you don't know how evil he is, right? It's not clear. There's only one thing you do know about him. What do you know about him? There's only one thing we know that's negative about Yaakov. Well, two things, actually, that we know that's negative about Esav in the Torah itself. And one is,
His wives.
Right? So one is his wives, right? One is that he marries idolatrous wives. And the other one, which we've already seen, is
the
firstborn, because he's a glutton. Right? Because for food. Mm-hmm. Right, which he gulped down. Right? What's the only thing we know about this doctor? Right? What's the one thing we know about his quality?
He's a drunkard.
Right? That's the one thing we know. Right? And that can overpower everything, right? That he's going to go and eat and drink. That's what we know. In rabbinic literature, it says much worse. I gave you in 4. That on that day, right? In rabbinic literature, it's not just that Esav is evil. Esav is evil, and he expresses all his evil qualities on one day. The day he turns 13. Which, parenthetically, is the same day as what? What? That he buys the firstborn, which is the same day that Yaakov is cooking the lentil stew, right? So it all comes back same day, the day of the lentil stew, right? That same day, that's when Avram dies in rabbinic literature, right? That's when Yitzchak is in mourning. That's when Esav is a drunkard. Right? All those images come back to the same day that are all in our story, right? The sick father, the lentils, the person responsible for healing father, who's himself a drunkard, right, who's himself evil, all of it comes back to that day. Right? And on that day, what does the Talmud tell you in 4? On that day, Abraham, our father, passed away, and Jacob, our forefather, prepared a lentil stew to comfort Isaac, his father, as it was customary to stir mourners lentil stew. The Gemara explains, and what is different about lentils, that they in particular are the fare customarily offered to mourners. So they say in the West, meaning Eretz Yisrael and Israel, in the name of Rabba Bar Mari, just as the lentil has no mouth, it does not have a crack like the other legumes, so to a mourner has no mouth, that is, his anguish prevents him from speaking. Alternatively, just as the lentil is completely round, so to a mourning comes around to the inhabitants of the world. Right? So the lentils, right? The lentils is the paradigmatic mourning food. But then the Gemara asks, what's the practical difference between the explanations? The Gemara answers, the practical difference between them is whether you can console them with eggs. Fine. And then the Gemara continues, Rabbi Yochanan says, that wicked Esau committed 5 transgressions on that day that Abram died. He engaged in sexual intercourse with a betrothed maiden. He killed a person, denied the principle of God's existence, denied resurrection of the dead, and despised the birthright. Right? That day he did everything. Right? Idolatry, and right, murder, adultery, anything you can think of, he did that day. And yet, despite it all, despite the fact that on that same day, right, that same day that is alluded to in our story, the day of the lentils, right, the day of the sick father, right, despite the fact that he's a glutton and evil for all million reasons, one thing doesn't change. Yitzchak's life depends on Esav taking care of him. Right? Yitzchak loves him, kitzayid befiv. Yitzchak loves him because he feeds him. And you think through the drama of the biblical story, and you just have to ask yourself, what is it like to love your father, to be the proper heir for your father, and know that despite the fact that you're a good son, and you're the right heir, and you're going to carry on his legacy, the only person in the world who can really take care of your father, and really can, he has one good quality, he really can take care of your father. What's it like to grow up knowing that you can't be there for your father in the way that someone else who is the lowest of the low can? That is a very hard life to live. Right? We focus, when we read the biblical story, we don't think about how hard it's got to be in that situation.
But in that situation, why would he think that he's entitled to be the first one? You know, if there's his brother honored by his father, it's only his mother who interferes.
Well, that's the idea,
he's deserving.
Later, right? That's later. I mean, there's two different stories, right? The buying of the firstborn, right? It may not be deserving. He just says, look, I want it, right? I'm going to buy it off of you, right? He knows that he can do it. The second one where he steals the blessing, you're right. It's a very hard story. And you see that he hesitates, right? He says to his mother, but my father, right? He recognizes. Right, that's exactly the drama there, is he turns to his mother and he says, I know I can't, right, if my father finds out, he will curse me, right? My father isn't on the same page as you, right? Now, why does he do it? right? So there are many different reasons, but the simplest sort of traditional reason is because he knows his father doesn't understand the reality. That his brother may have one good quality, but one good quality doesn't make you a good person. But that only makes it worse, right? That drama is only worse, right? That you know that, right? It's very easy to say, my father is totally wrong. What's harder is to say, no, my father's 95% wrong. He's 5% right. There's one thing my brother does better, but it's the one that blinds my father because it's the one his life depends on, right? You're right. What would make him think that he deserves it? Well, it's not clear he thinks he deserves it as much as his mother thought he deserved it, but the reality is he does, right? You look in this story, is the doctor a good person? Right? Not particularly. Right? Not only is he a drunkard, he's so committed to his drunkenness that the assumption, the working assumption of the story, is that if the doctor goes to the bar, he won't leave the bar to save two people's lives. Right? That's the assumption. Right? That's the drama in the story. That this doctor is necessary to save the father and the sister, but is so low and so capricious, right, that once he hits, right, once it hits the end of his shift, right, and it's time to go to the bar, right, literally people could be dying and he will leave. Right? What would tell someone that they are better than that doctor or that brother? It's obvious, right? He really is that bad, right? He really is that low. He really is that, right, shallow. But it doesn't take away his one good quality, that he can save, right, that he can save the beloved members of the family.
If we just go a little ahead in the story of Esau, when he encounters Jacob, and Jacob is coming back, he embraces him, he kisses him. In other words, he forgives. And also, they bury their father in mutually. So these are also redeeming.
Before we jump to the end, right? Let's jump to that incident, but not to the end. Let's jump to the middle. Okay, we'll come to the end in just a moment. You're right, but before we jump that far, right? Right before they reconcile, what happens? Right before they actually reconcile, what happens with Jacob? He sees 400 men, and what does he do?
He divides his camp.
He panics, right? And he tries to prepare for war. He divides his camp, he prays, he sends gifts. Why does he panic?
He feels guilty.
He remembers that his brother said he's going to kill him.
Ah, so the simple, you read the Torah, you say he's afraid because his brother wants to kill him. But Chazal, right, the rabbis, in traditional rabbinic thought, and remember, Agenon always doesn't just draw on the Torah, he draws on Midrashic literature. He loves drawing in Midrashic literature. In Midrashic literature, Jacob's fear is unjustified. Why is it unjustified? Why is it unjustified?
Yitzchak isn't dead yet?
Yitzchak is dead at this point. Well, no, he's not. You're right, he's not dead. But why is it unjustified? The Torah has a better reason why it's not justified, which is, right, if you skip to, right, go to 5 and 6. 5 and 6. He is afraid. Vayira Yaakov ma'od vayitzer lo. Right, Jacob was greatly frightened in his anxiety. Right, vayachetz am asherito v'atzon medavakar v'am l'shnei machanot. He divided the people with him, the flocks and the herds and camels, into two camps. But in rabbinic literature, it's not justified. Why? Because of 6. Because God had promised him, "I'll take care of you." I'm going to protect you wherever you go. And I'm going to bring you back to the land. I won't leave you until I've done what I promised you. Now, in rabbinic literature, it's unjustified to be afraid if God told you he'll protect you. Right? So the rabbis say in 7, how could he be afraid? You can't be afraid if God said you're going to be safe. What type of unbeliever are you? So they say, Amr lay. So the rabbah says, he wasn't just afraid. He wasn't afraid Esau was going to kill him. Why was he afraid he was going to kill him? Shema yigrom hachet. He was afraid that he had sinned. Kidir Yaakov baridi, the rabbi, the rami k'tiv, inenochi machush martich v'chol asher teileich. Uktiva ira Yaakov mod vayitzolosha yare shem yigromache kedetanya yavor amcha Hashem v'yershoni yavor amzukanita zubiyeshnia. So the Talmud says, why was he afraid? It's a contradiction. God said he's going to protect him, and yet he was afraid. So it says no, because he thought he would sin. But many people say, which sin exactly was he afraid of? Right? So some of the commentaries say, you know which sin he was afraid would cause him to die?
He'd have to kill Esav.
So in a different midrash, it says he might kill Esav. But others say, you know what sin? It wasn't any sin. Which sin?
The deception.
He was worried because he actually had one. But in another midrash, it's even worse. Right? It's not sin. It's the sin for him might be that it's not the deception, but in another midrash, it is the fact that he didn't honor his father. But it's more than that. It's the contrast. Right? The midrash in 8 says, "Kol ha'shanim alalu yoshev mechaved harav, tomar shubala mikoch kibud av ha'im." And he's afraid that he's going to sin, and his brother has one thing over him. His brother honors his parents. So the Midrash tells you that it's not just he's afraid of sin. What's he afraid of? That the one thing his brother holds over him, namely honoring father, is going to be his downfall. Right? That he, as good as he is, has one flaw. He couldn't take care of his father. He didn't. He had to leave. And his brother has one redeeming quality. And that is that he can take care of his father. But it's even more than that. And here, let's go meta for a moment. The story of Yaakov and Esav in rabbinic literature isn't just a story about Yaakov and Esav. It's a story about the interactions forever between the descendants of Yaakov, the Jewish people, and the descendants of Esav, which become Rome, which become Christianity, which becomes Europe, which becomes, right? Esav becomes the paradigm. So if you skip here to 17. Midrash says as follows. Yaakov made Esav cry one cry. As it says, when Esav heard his father's words, he cried a cry. Where was this paid back? In Shushan. In the Megillah, in Purim. Because Haman is from Amalek. And Amalek is from Esav, as it says, and he cried a bitter cry. In Midrashic literature, right, it's not just a fear. Yaakov isn't just afraid that his brother's ability to honor his father and his deception of his father is going to lead to his downfall. It literally almost does. It literally almost leads to the death of the entire Jewish people. Why? Because Esav will, right, have the upper hand because of his honoring of the father. And in 18, Ziva Shamir points out in a fascinating article that it's not just that in rabbinic literature, Esav's ability to honor his father puts the Jews in danger in the time of Purim. Bialik, right, who often you find Agnon playing on Bialik, because they played, you know, they were fans of each other's literature, shall we say, right? But he plays on Bialik. Bialik loved the image of the red lentils. And he used to play in his writings on the image of the red lentils and the red wine, on Adashim and Adom. And he would use them both to describe the drunk anti-Semitic Ukrainian who would go out to the bar, right, and attack the Jew. So Ziva Shamir says this isn't just, right, this story doesn't just invoke biblical images of Yaakov and Esav. It invokes historical images of Yaakov and Esav, namely the Yaakov-esque figure who needs to save his father is beholden to the Esav, the historical Esav, the Ukrainian, right, the sort of image of that Ukrainian drunkard who drinks the Adashim, right, who drinks the red, the Edom, the Adashim. And in Bialik's writing, whenever you find red and lentils, you find a Ukrainian who is the historical Esav, the historical Edom, right? So And he also wonders if Bordeaux in England is really a play in Bor Davai, which is hell, right? Which is like purgatory, is like the pits of destruction, right? That it's, right, this weird place is calling together, you know, these images of like the hell of Europe, right? Some of the worst parts of European culture. But now if you come to, yeah.
But Bordeaux is also a very famous French area for wine.
Oh, for sure, right? But that's clearly the play, right? That he's saying Bordeaux, the function of the story is wine, but it's Bordeaux in England, right? Which makes you wonder what's going on, yeah.
So, I know we have the concept of Ma'aseh Avod Siman Levanim, but are we really condemned because of something that happened in history and in biblical times to really, for this to just literally, like we're fated to reenact it and there's no escape?
At some level, rabbinic literature sees it that way, right? We are, right?
But it's meaning, such a depressing...
Well, it has goods and bads, right? We live off the merit of our forefathers, and sometimes we relive it and face the consequences of their actions, right? Rabbinic literature is filled with this, right? There is no punishment in the history of Jewish people that doesn't carry with it a little bit of the atonement of the sin of the Egel, right? Of the golden calf, right? And that's what they're saying. Literally, Jewish history, you can't escape your past. But now, let's go back to the story, right? How do we get into all of this, right? I want to suggest that the story, right, is, in many ways, Agnon's ruminations on the complexity of both the biblical narrative and the historic experience that the Jewish people have lived in light of that biblical narrative. Because as I said, the drama that we don't think of in the biblical story is that Yaakov, the Jew, right, the good person, he wants to be the one there for his father, right? He wants to be the one for his sister, right? But he's fated to lose his father and to lose his sister. Why? Because he's beholden to the one person who can take care of them. And that's hard, to know that you really want to take care of them. You really deserve to carry on the legacy. But there's somebody else who can take care of them better. He's low. He's shallow. He's so low. He's a drunkard. And he's so low that not only is he a drunkard, but that he would be willing to let people die if it interfered with happy hour, right? At the bar, you missed the 9 o'clock deadline, and they might die. What does it feel like, right, in the biblical story, for Yaakov to know that as good as he is, if what he cares about is taking care of his father, he's only second best. Or the only person who can take care of his father doesn't deserve to be the hero. And yet, he is. And yet, he could be. Right? That's the drama, the biblical story. Right? Yeah, you steal the firstborn because you deserve it. But there's something wrong there, because your father doesn't want to give it up. Your father doesn't want to give the blessings either, right? Because he really is. This isn't fake. He has one redeeming quality. And then, you know, following Shamir's analysis, that complexity in the story isn't just a one-time thing in history. Because as much as the Yaakov-Esav dynamic continues to play itself out in Europe, right? In the European mentality, the Ukrainian, right, the drunk Ukrainian is Esav. Still, in the end of the day, right, how often were the Jews beholden to the same people who they were afraid would have a pogrom the next day?
Yeah,
right? One second, yeah?
And yet, the writer bears some culpability in this also, because this Underman is... He's not really forcing him. He's staying with him. He can't get away from him. So there's like something about a dog bit him. There's something.
Right. So we haven't even gone to Underman.
Guilty of.
Yes. Yes. We haven't even gone to the Underman thing yet. We'll come back
because
to that in a moment.
If he got to this doctor before 9, the doctor would take care of him.
Correct.
It's his fault that he's not
good.
To the doctor.
Right. So let's jump for a moment to Underman. So who's this Underman? Right. Who is this Underman? So let's think about it. Right. What is the role of Underman here? Right, Underman is, right, Underman, right, Underman, right, perhaps from other, from hell, right, something like that, right, a demonic figure, right? And, you know, and rabbinic literature is full of this notion, right? The demonic figures that try to stop the patriarchs from doing what they're supposed to
do. Could be like the Malach of Esav?
So he could be the Malach of Esav, right? You know, it could be for all, you know, I wonder, it could be the image of Lavan, right? Because the one person who keeps Yaakov away from his father for 20 years, right, is Lavan. Now, why would I say it's Lavan, besides for the fact that he happens to be the person who keeps him away, right? So here, I didn't put the source here, but there's another rabbinic image that would help this. Because what does he say about Mr. Anderman? He says to Mr. Anderman, right, Mr. Anderman says, I'm going to come visit your father with my father. And he says...
Your house, he said.
Right, I mean, come to your house, right?
Yeah.
And he says, his father? Does Mr. Anderman have a father, right? In rabbinic literature... Lavan has a missing father. Right? Why does he have a missing father? Because in rabbinic literature, they note something interesting. That when Eliezer goes to find a wife for Yitzchak, they consult with Bituel, the father of Rivka, and with Lavan. And in the beginning of the story, Bituel, the father, is doing the negotiating. And then... sometime in the middle of the story, Bituel just disappears. He stops talking, and Lavan picks up. Right? Lavan starts negotiating on behalf of his sister. And the rabbis ask the question, where is his father? Right? Where is his father? And the answer is, right? The rabbis answer, he died in the middle of the story. You know why he died in the middle of the story? Because he poisoned himself. Because he was trying to kill Eliezer, and he ended up, right, an angel switched the food, and he ate it himself, right, and he died. But Lavan, who's the person who keeps Yaakov away from his house for 20 years, who's the person who is guilty, right, in rabbinic literature is the person who the rabbis ask, where did his father go? Because he's in the story, he's talking, and then suddenly... he evaporates into thin air. He's the person whose father disappears. And he's also the person who keeps him away. But you're right. Is it totally Lavan's fault? No, because it doesn't actually force him. He just makes it hard for him to leave. Right? Lavan never tells him you aren't allowed to go. What does he do? Wait, wait. No, you want to marry another daughter? Wait another 7 years. Work another 7 years. And Yaakov says, I really got to go, right? 14 years later, I got to go home. No, don't leave. Don't you need money, right? Don't you need money, right? Don't you need to work? I'll pay you. Stay, right? I mean, it keeps happening. He doesn't stop. He doesn't force him to stop, right? He just makes it hard. He makes it uncomfortable, right? He doesn't want to leave, right? He could, but Mr. Anderman, you're right. The protagonist is somewhat responsible. Not fully responsible. He really is being held up, but not held up at gunpoint. He could leave if he wanted to, but he's embarrassed to leave. Right? He's embarrassed to leave impoverished. He's embarrassed to leave without the wife he wants. Right? He's embarrassed. He's not comfortable. It's not time to go home. He could. He could go back. He could run and get the father. Right? He could run and meet the doctor. Right? Re-meet the doctor, who, as we said, at the end of the day, Esav, he will reconcile, right? That is the end of the story. They'll reconcile. Whether it's a sincere reconciliation or not, the rabbis argue about, we don't know, right? The end of that story is also ambiguous, right? We never quite know. But you're right, right? Mr. Anderman, being someone who stops him, is one of these images where he stops him. It's true, but you also wonder, it makes you wonder. It starts off and you think that the protagonist of the story is this great person doing everything to save his father. But then you realize, because of a little bit of embarrassment, right, he's uncomfortable to see the bite in the back, the tear in the back of his shirt. He lets himself get delayed because he'd rather not be embarrassed. But remember what's at stake, right? His father's life. He may not see his father again if he doesn't manage to get the doctor. Right? Yaakov never sees his mother again because his mother dies before he gets back because he allowed himself to get delayed. Now, just one second. The same author, Ziva Shamir, suggests a different person. And he says under, right, can mean, right, either under or it can mean other. Yeah. Right, it can mean other. Now he says in rabbinic literature there is an other. Right? There's a person named Other. Acher. Right? There's a... Well, in rabbinic literature, there's someone named Elisha ben Avuya. Right? Elisha ben Avuya, who is the Tana who goes off. He's a member of the Mishnaic group, and then he goes and becomes a heretic. And he is the constant person who makes it difficult for the rabbis. He constantly makes it difficult for the rabbis. Why does he make it difficult for the rabbis? Because he is one of them, but he chose to leave, which means that sometimes he'll one-up them in rabbinics, right? You have stories where he'll tell Rabbi Meir, right, on Shabbos, he'll be riding on his horse, and they'll get to the point you're not allowed to walk on Shabbos, and he'll tell Rabbi Meir, look, I know how to count the steps of my horse. You aren't allowed to walk more, right? Turn around. And Rabbi Meir will say, me turn around? You know so much Torah. Why don't you turn around? He says, I gave it up. I can never go back. I can't be a good person, right? But he can one-up him. But why? So why does Ziva Shamir think, though, that on Mr. Anderman is Achir, that he's calling into, he's invoking the image of this rabbinic figure who is on the one hand an insider, on the other hand an outsider, besides for the word Achir. So he says that there's a tragic story in Chagiga number 20, where the Talmud says that at some point the daughter of Acher came to Rehuda Hanasi and said, please support me, because my father was Acher, was a scholar. And Rebbe said to her, so what? He was also a heretic. He went off. I don't care that he was once a scholar. And she gets into an argument with him and says, no, remember his Torah, do not remember his deeds. And a fire descends from heaven, right, and burns up the bench that Rehuda Hanasi is on, and he starts crying, and he says, If someone who's deserted the Torah, but still once learned, that merit is enough, that God himself will send down a fire to tell me I should take care of his daughter, how much more someone who's good? But isn't that what's going on here, right? What's Mr. Anderman? We don't know much, right? The imagery about Mr. Anderman is something about his father, right? We don't know about his father, but this notion of parents, right, and their questionable relationship is invoked. But what else is invoked? This person who has, right, one, right, again, that one good quality thing that somehow overpowers his other qualities. Now, you also have in this element, you know, the chazan, right? The you know, who's also there, who's the good person, right? It's like the Yetzer Tov, right? Who's saying, I'm waiting for you, right? I could give you advice, but he never manages to quite get to him because he's there while Mr. Anderman is there, right? There's that part of Yaakov that wants to leave, that maybe wants to go back to who he should be, but he can't, right? It's all at the same time. In the end, we don't know whether he gets it, right? He actually ever reaches the doctor, which is true in Yaakov's life also, right? He never meets his mother. He never sees his mother again, right? He does see his father. He may see his father again, right? And I think that this story, with all its mythic qualities, right? We're not quite sure what's going on, is drawing on the images of Yaakov and Esav, and the complexity of that story, where the righteous one is, despite it all, dependent on someone whose only qualities he can take care of him. Which in the biblical story, we don't think about, right? We don't think about that part of the drama, right? How hard it is to be someone to know that it's not a pure mistake your father is making, because that doctor, right, Esav has one redeeming quality. He really can take care of your father. He's a lowlife, right? He is. He's a drunkard and a sinner. Right, this doctor is a lowlife, right? He would let two people die rather than give up his bar. But the fact remains, you can't take care of your father without him. Right? And you lose not one relative, but two, right? Like Yaakov does, right? Your life, because of this, will just, right, spiral out of control. It's not just your father you're going to lose. You're going to lose other loved ones, right? Because that one story is going to lead to all this, right, drama. And then you're going to get there. And you're going to get delayed by this seedy character. He's not going to force you not to go back. You are. You're right. You're going to have culpability because it's not totally your fault. You were delayed. But on the other hand, you know, at some point, at the beginning, you're this great son who's trying to carry your father. But then a little bit of embarrassment. And it's not just the doctor suddenly who's willing to let your father die. But a little bit of embarrassment, a little bit of discomfort. You know, you forget the mission you're on for a little bit. You almost get delayed too much. Right, Yaakov is a complex figure, right? He really does want to take care of, he wants to do the right thing, but there's someone who can take care of him better, and he wants to get back to his father, but he gets delayed by someone who, given, is not a great person. And then as Shamir notes, this complexity isn't just something that the Jews, that Yaakov and Esav lived through. It's part of the history. Right? It's part of history because Esav's one quality, according to rabbinic literature, is what leads the Jews' endangerment in the Shushan story, because as evil as he was, they had a good quality. And in Bialik's writing, right, this is the constant struggle of the Jewish people, because, you know, we always have the Esavs in our lives, right? The Ukrainian drunkard. But the reality is, they lived in Ukraine. There was probably a doctor there that one day might run a pogrom, and the next day, right, or the day before, when you needed something, you might have to go to him anyways. That's the complexity of Jewish life in Europe, in Galus, always, is that we don't want to be beholden to the people who are really not great people, but we are. They have redeeming qualities. Even the worst of people have redeeming qualities. We need them. And sometimes it's not only their fault. Sometimes it's our fault too. Right? Sometimes when we don't do the right thing, it's our fault too. Right? Because we get caught up in, you know, I don't want to turn around. I don't want to see someone see that I have a rip on my shirt. Then it's our fault. Not totally our fault. Things are difficult. Right? I'm stressed out. And how does Agnon do this? By invoking all those images of the sick father and the dying sister of Yitzhak and Leah, of the hated wife, right? Who really he should love, right? Really he should love, right? It's a moment of hatred, right? The classic case, right? He burnt the soup, but really he should love her because she's still his wife, right? The Leah, right? He is responsible for that, right? It was, you know, in the story, it's irresponsible for him to hate his wife because she burnt the soup, because she's running after him, right? Helping him get to the doctor. She even gets there before him, right? She shouldn't be hating his wife, but he does, right? You're right, the protagonist isn't perfect. But that's the complexity of Yaakov. He's mostly good. He's trying to do the right thing, but he's beholden to someone who can take care of his father more than him. He hates the wife that he really shouldn't, right? He really shouldn't, because he's caught up in his love of his father and the other wife, the little sister of Rachel, right? And that's a mistake. And when he's trying to get back to his father, he lets himself get distracted by someone who's not great, right? The Mr. Anderman, the person with the missing father, right? The Lavan character, right? Or the Acher character. But at some level, he bears responsibility because he is imperfect. And so Agnon writes this story of Jewish history, right? That's biblically true and historically true. That we try to do the right thing, but we know that sometimes we get caught up in petty things and we're responsible for some of the bad things that happen to us. On the other hand, we may be right to look down on our enemies. But on the other hand, we also can't deny the complexity that we are beholden to them, that they have good qualities, that we need them, right? The Ukrainian drunkard may also be the Ukrainian doctor. And therefore, and I think the mythic quality of the story helps, because there's no resolution to it. It's not a story. Some of Agnon's stories come to a conclusion, right? You know what the answer is. In this story, you don't know what happens, right? You don't know what happens. All you know is that there are these complex relationships that drive this person, right? He's beholden to this person. He needs this person. He doesn't want to be. He lets himself be delayed. He doesn't know whether his delay led to him doing the wrong thing and now a catastrophe happening. But that was Jewish life in Europe, right? You just didn't know. You didn't have a choice but to live this life, but you also didn't know what was going to happen. So the story ends with this mythic note, right? You go over the river and it's swelling and it's ominous. And maybe you reach the doctor and he saves the people's life, or maybe he doesn't. And life is tenuous and people are complicated and good. And the people who you need one day may be terrible people, and you might be mostly good, but you're also somewhat bad, and you might be responsible for the situation. That's life. That's Bible. That's Jewish history. That's everything. But you can't say that, right? As is always true, you can't just say that. You can say that, but no one will ever listen, right? The way you describe complexity, you make people feel complexity, is by telling a story where the elements make you think, right? Confuse you a little bit, right? Make you imagine, because that makes you not just think, but feel about the complexity of life, both the biblical story and about Jewish history, and the way we live out Jewish history and live out the complexities of the narrative. And that's why I think this very story of El HaRofe, right, is his powerful, profound ruminations, ponderings about those complexities of the Yaakov character and the way we continue to relive those complexities in the world of Europe, in the world of Galut, in the world of the diaspora. And the story doesn't have an ending. It leaves you with those questions. because it's not meant to answer the questions. It's meant to highlight the complexity that's inherent in the human experience and in the Jewish experience and make you at least aware of those questions that you might not have thought of asking. So that's my take on El Arofe as a commentary on the Yaakov Esav story. I think there's more to unpack, but I wanted to focus on that biblical element because that's always my favorite part of Agnon. I'll take a few questions and then, you know, without...
The bridge, the black bridge breaks and all that water. Anyway, is it the Mabul or something?
So I don't know if it's the Mabul. I don't know. I wondered whether it's the Midrashim of Avram, right? That Avram, when he's trying to go do the right thing at the Akedah, the Satan comes to him and appears as a river, right? And tries to drown him on his way, right? And he only manages to... Right, only when he goes, you know, keeps going and actually goes and it's over his head, does Hashem tell the Satan, you got to stop, you can't actually kill him, right? The river is that image that the Satan takes up on when he's trying to stop someone from doing the right thing. So I wonder whether that's the ominous image. I'm not quite sure. There's all types of possibilities in rabbinic literature. Yeah?
I just wanted to ask you if you could explain, I read the Ziva Shamir's book, the articles, and she's kind of sees that there's a hopeful element with this imagery of the waves and Kabbalistic. And
yeah,
sure if you could
right. So I didn't quite gather, but yeah, she likes a little bit, right, that waves and right and Kabbalistic imagery are like the, I think it was more like the images of God's emanations in the world, right, that could be it, right? It's like the hidden, that God is there, right, in these emanations coming from heaven, right? This is like a classic sort of Kabbalistic image, right? There may be hidden Kabbalistic images. I know less about Kabbalah. I mean, I studied Kabbalah in graduate school, but I'm less sort of intimately aware of it. Also, you know, sometimes it's waves, sometimes described in other images. There may be a hopeful element to it, you know. I read the story, it feels much more ominous than hopeful, but it could be, right? She has different takes on this. You know, I just picked out some of her things, but she has a nice analysis of different elements, right? Not less the biblical ones. I picked out more the biblical ones, but yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Most of us read these stories as literature. And I think it's grossly unfair of Agnon to expect us to read it as biblical allegory, unless it gives us a clue that that's what he wants us to do.
So
that's what they say about Talmud. You know?
So right. So Agnon, but Agnon is always like that.
The first time you read it, if you're just reading it for a story. And it's a complete mishmash.
So Agnon really, though, does. He really is. I mean, all his writing, I mean, fair, unfair, I don't know whether to judge it, but Agnon really does draw on biblical, Talmudic, Midrashic imagery all the time, right? He expects you to be saturated in that knowledge to understand his images. He really does, right? It's not, I mean, it may be unfair, but he does expect it, right? There's no doubt, right? I mean, here he does have certain clues. But he expects his readers to know that lentils are symbolic of mourning, and the reason they're symbolic of mourning is from the story,
that's
Rashi.
That's the only word in the story that gives you a clue where he's taking it from.
Well, not necessarily, because the images of the dying, right, once you have the lentil hint, right, and his open allusion to the Midrash that says it's the food of mourning the day that Yaakov sells the firstborn, then you know he's talking about Yaakov, and suddenly you have a sick father, and you have the Achot Ktana dying, and suddenly all these other images from Yaakov, right, from Jacob's life become apparent, because, you know, anyone who's apparent, that's the one clue, right, that oddity where he turns it to you, but once you hit that clue, right, and you think about the original passage, right, the original passage brings together all the elements, because it brings together the sick father, and it brings together Esav, and it brings together Yaakov, right, all those, and once you're in that mindset. But, I mean, it might be unfair, but I think it's also undeniable that Agnon, you know, I don't know, if, you know, biblical allegory or biblical allusions, it's right, undeniable that Agnon goes out of his way to pull as many biblical and Talmudic and Midrashic allusions as he possibly can, because he has fun doing it.
And if the reader doesn't have a background in biblical knowledge...
Then he misses a lot of Agnon, right? Because Agnon isn't just another writer. Agnon is trying to write in a genre, but saturating it with images from Torah of all, right? I mean, that's what he's doing. It doesn't mean you can't get something out of the story without it, but I think it's part of you know, part of the reason Rai Turchiner especially loves it, right, is because he loves the fact that Agnon is trying in many ways to be a parshan, right, being a commentary on Torah through literature. He is, right? That may be, you know, again, it might be unfair, but it is what he's doing, you know.
I think eventually everything Agnon has ever written will come with annotated commentaries at the end, where we'll go back to the Talmud. All the notations that you've given, eventually everything by Agnon will have the Talmud and everything.
I wish people luck. He was quite knowledgeable.
Who was that?
He was quite knowledgeable, right? It's very impressive.
He knew it backward and forward, but we need commentators on every piece.
I'll leave it to like Jeffrey Sachs or something. That's his right. Right? Didn't he just come up with a book? I think he did. Yeah. What?
Are the illusions clearer?
I mean, a little bit, right? The Adashim would jump out, you, right? I mean, lentil is, sure, it's English and Hebrew, but yeah, some of these words would be more apparent. Yeah, Denny?
You mentioned that it seems strange that Yaakov would be nervous when God like previously says, like, I'm with you. And you mentioned the reason why he's nervous is because he did something wrong and Esau was doing something right, and therefore, like, because Esau was doing something right and he was doing something wrong, it could be that God at the end won't actually protect him. And it seems as though God saying I'll protect you happens way after both the Esau doing the right thing and Yaakov doing the wrong thing. And therefore, if he says I'll protect you after those two instances happen, why would Yaakov be fearful that God would say I'm not going to protect you because instances happened before?
Right. So I assume what the passage there and the Talmud is building on is the assumption that he, right, that in the middle of that promise and him getting to Lavan's house is the 14 years where he's, right, is 14 years where he's studying in the Yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever. So it's actually not after. I mean, it's after the stealing, but it's before a much more extended period where he's absent from his father while Esav is present, right? Because it's not just that one incident, right? In rabbinic literature, he leaves, right? He has this promise, and then he has 14 years where he's, right, just learning and delayed before he gets to Lavan, and during that whole period, Esav is taking care of his father. So it's not just a one-time incident, right? That's the beginning of it, right? But by time he's gotten there, it's been 14 years and then another 20, right? So it's been 34 years of continuous, right, building on this. So you're right that the one sort of, that single moment, right, happens after the promise, but the continuous honor that Esav shows to his father, right, has continued for decades since the promise, and they also fault him for not coming back earlier, right? So, there's been more sin and more kibbut avim that happened since then, right? But also, it may just be that they're, you know, you also have to figure out how tightly to take the midrash, right? It's, and you know, also you have to wonder whether it really is that sin or it's other sins, right? But you're right, right? It's a bit hard to pin it just on that one moment of sin because it is after that sin.
A bridge is usually a symbol of bringing together two opposite shores, making a compromise, a synthesis, and so on. But here it's called the Black Bridge. So what, and it's going to be overcome by the swelling water. The bridge is going to be destroyed. So what is that?
Why?
Because I think you presented Esau and Jacob as the opposites of good and evil. But what I experience in reading this story, that those two elements exist in all of us, the Yetzer Ra and the Yetzer Tov. And the struggle is with all of us. They're not two separate things outside of us. So, and the Anderman, the other person, we project the evil to the other person, but it's actually inside us. So the struggle is inside us. It's not like two opposing camps.
Right, and it's possible that that's true here, that it's not, right? It's possible that it's not an external figure. It could just be that it's the personification of his own complexity. You're right. It's definitely possible, right? That it's the, you know, the personified other, right? Rather than the actual other, right? The personified other side of ourselves. Right? All those things are possible, and multiple could be true at the same time, right? It's a, you know, again, it's a more mythic story. There's a lot that could be true. It's very, right, surreal. Okay. Anyway,
yeah. Okay, I have to thank you. Let me start that we're going to miss you for your one lecture, you know.